Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Hi there. I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to announce a new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. Our guests this season show us big risk can yield big rewards. Like Rob Riley, the creative head of one of the world's leading advertising firms.
I try to create environments where anybody can say anything without any judgment.
Listen to a brand new season of Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
All right, welcome back to another Car Stories with Sung Kang
and Amelia Hartford. Sung, it's my turn for the questions.
All right.
I got a question for you. Would you survive a zombie apocalypse?
Oh, would I? Wow, that's a great question.
Would I
survive a zombie apocalypse like right now?
Yes.
Today, if it happened like in 5 minutes? Well, it depends on what kind of zombie. Are they fast zombies or are they slow zombies?
I'm talking like Walking Dead zombies.
They were slow. Well, I would be, yeah.
I'm not talking The Last of Us zombies.
Okay. Or I Am Legend zombies that run super fast.
Oh, no, not those zombies. The Walking Dead ones. The ones where they can't run, they could walk, but they'll eat your brains.
I would say that I'm not prepared at home.
Okay.
Like, I don't have, like, water reserves stuff. Actually, I do.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a bag that'll last me a month.
Okay.
Vin Diesel gave it to me.
That's awfully nice.
He gave me a survival bag. I don't know if it's still good. I don't know.
I think they lost a while.
So I have that, but I don't have any weapons.
Okay.
I don't have guns and stuff. But if they were to attack my home, like they were, would I be able to survive?
I think you're overthinking this a little.
I would hope. What do you think? Well, how about you?
Hell yeah, I would survive a zombie apocalypse.
You would?
Yeah, I would.
What makes you say that? Why so confident?
It's just my gut instinct. I feel like I have those instincts given a life or death situation to pull myself out of it. I don't know.
So if there was like two zombies coming in, you would be able to chop their heads off? Because you know, you gotta.
If I needed to, sure, they're dead.
So you would be okay doing that?
They're
zombies. How would you do that?
Depends. We're here right now, the iHeart Studios.
Yeah.
Grab a knife out of the kitchen.
But wait, there's no knife there. We couldn't even find a fork for lunch.
I found a knife. That's how I cut the sandwich in half.
Yeah, a butter knife.
It was a steak knife.
Yeah, but you're not going to kill a zombie doing that.
I could go upstairs. I could lock one of the doors. I could scale the side of the building. I could parkour to the next building.
You would do that?
I'd climb down to my car, my truck.
But what about Teji? You would just leave him behind?
We can take Teji.
Yeah, no. He would be...
He'd be
zombie
food.
If it was a female zombie, he would be trying to hump that zombie.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Yeah, I would hope I could survive, but I thought about this before. I was like, what would happen if zombies attacked my house and bit my wife and then she turned into a zombie?
Mm-hmm.
Would I just leave?
Yeah.
Or would I wait for her to be a zombie and then chop off her head?
I love that you've thought about this before.
I think about a lot of useless stuff.
Secondly,
yeah.
Why do you have to stay to chop her head off? Why not just leave?
Well, I don't want her to go around and exist, right, as a zombie.
But what if they come out with a potion or a formula
to solve that? Well, she still has to go around and like...
eat people?
Eat people, right? I would be sad. Like, what if like I'm... like in the neighborhood, like, you know, breaking into
people. You're just casually walking the dog. You see your zombie wife running by.
Well, no, I would have to go get supplies, right? Like I would break into someone's house to go get canned goods, right? You know, during the day. And then I see her like walking, just like, oh, right? Living dead, right? I would be sad.
Sure.
So I would want to end her misery.
Okay, I thought this was going to be a fun, like, would you survive zombie apocalypse? And now I'm thinking about deep. What it would take to murder a significant other.
Yeah, I mean, come on. Like, would you, okay, if you saw me and I was a zombie and you like, you were driving by me, would you just run over me to end my misery?
Would you want me to?
I would hope you would.
Then sure.
You would.
I'll squish your body so hard against that building with my truck.
You could do that?
Well, yeah.
You would do that?
It'd put you out of misery if that's what you wanted.
All right, appreciate that.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, so
Jesus.
Speaking of, I don't
of
know.
What?
There's no segue into
of what?
This. Yeah, speaking of kindness, of ending friends' misery, one of the kindest people I think in the community, and I mean, it was just amazing to talk to this wonderful, wonderful-hearted human being.
Yeah, Jeff Zwart.
Zwart.
Yeah, he's a racing driver. He's a director. He's a artiste, photographer, videographer, you name it.
I mean, he was just dropping words of wisdom.
Yeah.
Right? Just his philosophy of people being passionate about what they do. You know, that's the beginning and that's the end, you know? So it was just a privilege and honor to sit down with him.
Yeah.
And be able to just listen to his words. So, yeah.
Without further ado, Jeff Zwart.
Now, for the listeners that aren't familiar with your career, you started in print and then you went into commercial directing and then you went into narrative film directing.
Yeah.
So how did you get your start in print photography?
My fourth grade field trip we lived in Wilmington, Delaware. My fourth grade field trip, my parents gave me an Instamatic camera to actually go take pictures on it. So they did that. But funny enough, you know, as you grow up, when you stop wanting to be a fireman or an astronaut, you know, or these kind of all these kind of typical things, my goal was to be a veterinarian. I loved animals. I loved that whole process. And I always had a dog. When I was born, my dad, he was a sharpshooter in the Navy. Hmm. When I was born and came home, he took his rifle down the street and traded it for a dog.
Aww.
Every boy, he in his mind, needed to have a dog.
Wow.
And so from that point on, we've always had a dog. But so dogs and animals and everything were so part of my life. And so naturally, the veterinary part was very interesting to
me. Wait. Why did your dad feel that every boy needed a dog?
Don't they say dogs are man's best friend?
Yeah. And it's also, it's just nice to have a non-communicating relationship with something where you're not a verbal communicator with it so much. You just sense this wonderful animal is here for you and I'm here for this wonderful animal. And we don't sit down and have long talks about things or share things, but there's a communication and a relationship that develops that is just pure.
Mm.
It's like, you know, right now, you know, we live in Colorado, and it's just wonderful to just watch the dogs go out and be dogs every day. No fences, no anything. And you just sit there and you kind of look at that dog and go, what's going through his mind or her mind or whatever? I really like that. So the veterinary side was really kind of to help dogs. You know, that's a whole nother level and to be able to do that. And I love the fact that, again, the dog doesn't come in and tell you what its problems are. You know, you need to look at it. You need to spend time with it. And even in the days of when I was involved in veterinary medicine, it was, you know, there weren't even a lot of testing and there weren't MRIs and there weren't all the things that we do for our dogs now. It was really more of just like looking and listening to the owners and, you know, feeling things on the dog and just seeing where are the problems, what can we do? And it kind of really... very spiritual to kind of get in the head and the body of the dog to decide what to do with it. But anyway, I my plan was to go to veterinary school here in the United States, but then all of a sudden it looked like, oh, maybe it would be a little easier to get in the veterinary school in Europe. So I went to Germany.
That's a huge.
Yes. Yeah. It was a big deal.
This was, you were how old?
I would have been 19 years old.
You're just like, it's going to be easier to go to vet school or become a veterinarian. Yeah, because
it's
in
very
Europe.
Hard.
To,
it's very but, hard. But, in California, just, yeah. was, at that time, one veterinary school, yeah. UC Davis, 90 spaces, I think. It was easier for me to be a doctor than it would have been to a veterinarian. Wow. It was very, very.
It's still hard.
It still is hard. Yeah. Huh. And so, but there were 19 foreign student positions. So I thought, well, I'm going to do that. I flew to Frankfurt, took a train to Munich, got off the train in Munich. I stayed in a youth hostel, and I went around Munich going to all the veterinarians, showing up in there saying, do you need an assistant? Because I decided that for the first year, I needed to go there, learn the language, do everything I could. And the only thing I really knew how to do was to be a veterinary assistant, because that's what I'd done in the U.S., Ultimately, somebody knew another veterinarian that needed help, and it was a large animal veterinarian, and I started working for a large animal veterinarian outside of Munich. But the thing that simultaneously kind of happened once I got settled into that was, as you can in Europe, on Friday nights, I would get on a train and take the train to somewhere else in Europe and go to a race. Because I loved racing. And here I was in Europe to get to see racing from Formula One to sports car racing to whatever. And so I would spend Saturday and Sunday at the races and figure out ways to sit, sneak into the pits and do all those kind of things that you could do then. And
what a, be close during to, that era to be able to go to races in Europe.
Yeah.
I thought, God, what a time to be alive.
Oh, it was. And it was Niki Lauda and James Hunt and, you know, all those kind of great things, which I'll tell you a little funny moment relative to that, but I was literally, you know, with my little camera that I had kind of evolved from that Instamatic in fourth grade, I had a camera with me and would photograph the races and be right there in the middle of things. And I just came to this realization that, you know, this is where I really wanted to be. I was allowed to be around cars. The people that were closest to the action were the photographers. So I wrote my parents a letter from Europe after being there for about 9-10 months. And I said, you know, I don't think I want to be a veterinarian anymore. I want to be a photographer. And, you know, you have to wait for that to come back now.
Yeah.
So then the letter comes back and I open the letter and said, well, you know, that's going to be a really difficult life because my parents knew nothing about photography, you know, as a career. I really didn't know anything about photography, but they just said, we'll support you, but you know, if you're a veterinarian, you've got it kind of made. You know, you'll be a doctor and all this stuff. But if you want to be a photographer, you need to come back to the United States and need to figure out where you're going to go to school because we can't help you in that. And so, that was my life change, and it was not because I love photography, but because photography was the way to be around cars.
Mm-hmm. Wow!
So that was really it. And as it turned out, you know, I did eventually really love photography. I did all that. I just, in my head, the driving force was, this is my way to be around cars. You know?
Do you think because you love cars and racing, you were able to capture in your photography the cars in a unique way compared to other photographers that would just take a picture of a car racing?
Yeah. That was really true. And it still works to this day. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many subjects that relate to what you just said is that, you know, it was the speed, it was the motion, it was the things like that to it that I was so attracted to. I was less interested in just freezing the car. I wanted the motion and things. And my highest aspiration was someday shoot something for Road and Track magazine, because that's what I'd grown up with. My family was this magazine that came every month. Well, of course, when I got out of Art Center, I thought, you know, if I could just do something. So the offices for Road and Track were in Newport Beach. And I went down to those offices and my first assignment was a cover with them. So it just, it took off from there. But also I started covering Formula One for Road and Track magazine. And I'd go to the Brazilian Grand Prix and shoot the Formula One spotter's guide and do all these things. But it was always about motion and action and blurred backgrounds and kind of creating it maybe more artful. And funny enough, I mean, who would have ever thought that somebody was reading Rodent Track magazine and they're at a company that builds fighter planes and they call me up and say, could you come up to our offices for a meeting? And I come up there and they have all my Formula One work from Rodent Track magazine. They're saying, we would like you to shoot our fighter planes like you shoot Formula One. And I'm like, how do I get in this situation? Ultimately, it led to me being Martin Baker ejection seat certified, went through all the training that you do basically to be a pilot. And I flew back seat with this little card I carried with me and F-18s and almost everything that way, and photographed fighter planes the way I did F1. And it was just kind of a magical moment. But amazing. It came from Rodent Track, came from shooting the Formula One cars. Wow. So
came from something that you were passionate about.
Yeah, really. Absolutely.
What a great lesson.
Absolutely.
You know? Can you look back in your life and see everything connect?
Oh, God.
The
amount of full circle moments, it still to this day gives me chills. Just around motorsport or whatever. You know, I get a call through my office that Ron Howard wants to have a meeting about a movie he's working on. And it was the movie Rush.
Wow.
And he says, can we meet for breakfast? I really like the way you approach shooting cars and action and everything. He said, could we just have a breakfast one day? And so I go down and I'm sitting there and I didn't know what he was working on, but I'm sitting there with Ron Howard. And then to get his perspective that says, this is about James Hunt and Niki Lauda.
Mm.
And I go back to, I'm a veterinary, working for a veterinarian in Europe, in the pits at Dutch Grand Prix in Zandvoort.
Shooting
Niki Lauda and James Hunt. It's like, wow.
Wow.
You know.
Ron Howard is a real special human being, huh?
Yeah. I loved his diligence in studying it.
Yeah. I did this table read for a film that he was going to potentially do, and we never did it. And it put things into perspective, like meeting him. Like first, you know, I grew up watching him on Happy Days and the Andy Griffith Show, right? And Andy Griffith Show is a black and white TV show.
We have to put things in perspective. Yeah.
She's like,
room. Read the room.
I never watched it, but I know what you guys are talking about.
You should never watch it. Anyway, it's great TV. Hey, but Ron Howard is like a little boy. Like he's really the little boy of the local sheriff, right? And not. But anyway, so we're in his production office in Beverly Hills, and then I went to the I was like, hey, can I use your bathroom? And he had a bathroom in his office. He goes, yeah, you can use that one. And I'm using his toilet. There was an Oscar on the toilet. And I was like, I guess this is what he thinks of what these actually mean at the end of the day. It's really the experience, really, you know, that he values. It's like, at the end, it's just a statue, right?
Yeah.
And it was like one of those like full circle moments to be able to work with this icon.
It is. And I think you really need to appreciate those moments too. And it really puts things in perspective. Even for like, funny enough, I shot the first, I think I shot 4 seasons of GT Academy, the real,
really?
Real GT Academy.
Wow. So, connective.
So, you know, so here we are, you know, Amelia and I thinking about that, you know, then the movie comes along, but you know, it's like, I was living 4 years with a group of kids that basically had qualified by gaming. And then we'd put them literally on day one in a GTR, you know, on Silverstone. And it was to watch the mental load, the physical load, the racecraft develop, all these things that would have to kind of all come together to succeed in that. It was a fascinating process. And then here you are, you know, coming off the movie. It was just, again, a really fun, you know, circle moment of watching that evolve into something that was bigger than we ever imagined in the beginning.
So. What were some of the characteristics that stood out of the individuals that excelled?
Mm.
You know, even, yeah. I mean, that's a question yeah. through life,
yeah,
right?
It really is. Yeah, yeah. It really is. It was kind of hard to watch sometimes because people were so serious there. The competitors were so serious and tried so hard. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, racing is so much a part of economics in a lot of ways, today's racing. And there was no economics in there. You know, you qualified or you didn't. It wasn't the, you know, how you were bankrolled or anything. So for them to arrive there, it was really kind of multiple great human interest stories of guys that are just living, breathing, everything about it was, you know, basically in the hands of this 1 week-long event. And the problem in the, not the problem because the game prepared them so well, but there was no consequence in the game for them to get there. And I couldn't believe how fast the competitors would ramp up. They would go quick right away because they'd raced with no consequence to get there. And then the other side of it too was is that they would be able to manage the cars so often because some of this, part of this, I would ride with them sometimes and film and do things. And you just, you know, knowing what I knew, their car control was so good. And a lot of times it would come back to saying, well, I have so little physical feedback in the game that now that I'm in a car, that extra feedback I have actually really helps. You know, I really understand it. It's obviously something you have to adapt to, but the ability to kind of ramp up and go quickly right away was always surprising to me. Because I remember in some of the beginnings, you know, some of these guys had never even driven a manual transmission.
Yeah.
You know, they qualified in the game, but they never had driven a manual transmission. And the things that they'd have to deal with was really fascinating. And it was interesting because it became more entertainment in this as we went through the seasons rather than pure racecraft and everything that you needed to do to be a racing driver. It needed to be a little more entertaining season after season. And I think that...
Like a reality show?
Yeah, yeah. And it became... probably the results were less pure to what it took to be a racer.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Rosie, somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned. It feels so good.
It does. And like always, we'll be here every week covering the wide world of TV, movies, comics, and geek culture.
That's right. We'll be talking about Batman, heroes of that stature, and of course, we'll be inviting our friends in the industry to come geek out with us and share stories. We'll hear from TV writers, from actors, comics creators, pop culture critics, and more.
Nothing is off the table, because geek culture is pop culture, and we can't wait to share our love of it all with you every single week.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to announce a new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. Our guests this season remind us to embrace change and fearlessly look toward the future. Like Andrew Jarecki, award-winning filmmaker and creator of Movie Phone.
The studios didn't really control the theaters didn't control the studios. And I thought, well, there's a window in here where I could make things easier for the consumer and also make something that would be very useful for the industry.
Or Kellen Kenny, Chief Marketing and Growth Officer at AT&T, who installed fiber in customers' houses rather than leading from afar.
It is so crucial that you spend time with the customers. That is the best lesson.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to a brand new season of Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry, though. He's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I mean, when you bought that 914-6, it was the affordable Porsche.
Yeah.
But today, that's not affordable.
No, I mean, honestly, like hardly anything is really. But yeah. But yeah, it was my cheapest way to get into a six-cylinder Porsche.
How much was that when you bought it?
I think $3,800 or $4,200, something like that.
Wow.
Oh my God.
The story, you know, we can get into it, but the story of getting that car is kind of very defining for my whole kind of world. So I had a paper route like at 13 years old. And so my dad, my dad was a mechanical engineer who specialized in plastics. And my mom was a school teacher. So it's kind of the environment. I was the only child. And so I kind of just, grew up in that kind of environment, but I had a paper route. And his deal was I had to invest half my money in the stock market.
Hmm. Wow.
And it was just kind of like, you know, in retrospect, I guess just teaching you to be conscious of your money and not just like, you know, every month getting my little paycheck from my paper out of spending it. So it also allowed you to kind of research and what would I be interested in investing in and things like that. And then when I graduated from high school, the deal was I could buy my first car. And my dad had a early 911, and which is kind of a fairly well-known story, but it was actually chassis number 35 911. It was a 901. So like this would be a revered, amazing car to own today. It just, for my dad, happened to be the oldest, most affordable 911 he could buy at the time, which was also a used car at the time when he bought it. Mm. And so I love the sound of a six-cylinder motor. And a 911, I couldn't get a very new 911 at the time for the same amount of money, but I could get an almost brand new 914-6. And so that's what I bought. So I bought a 914-6, and I still have it to this day. It's on display at the Peterson Museum. Wow. But the cool things, too, is that car, you know, who would have ever thought that car kind of provided so many life experiences along the way, because I went off to college in it. You know, people who went to Art Center College of Design, where I went to college, they still remember, oh, you drove that yellow 914-6 in those
days.
That's
the color of my 914.
Is it?
I have a 914.
Oh, cool.
It's yellow, yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah, well, that was a color, and it's actually made me kind of, you know, I still really like yellow cars to this day. But the thing was, is, you know, like, if you look at back to the life, it's kind of been the common thread in so many ways. And, you know, I went to college in it, and I met my wife in it. You know, I was a skateboarder. I was a longboard skateboarder. And so I would be up in the hills in between classes in Pasadena at Art Center and skateboarding. And I met my wife. She was one of the girls giving rides back up the mountain after we'd skate down. And, you know, I was driving the 914-6 then. And then if you kind of go years later, in 19, I'd already been rallying and doing things in the U.S. Pro Rally Championship and racing at Pikes Peak and different things. But I had the opportunity to do a long-distance event, FIA Marathon Rally, which was 25 days, 10,000 miles from Panama to Alaska, and trying to decide what car to do that in and everything because it was such a big deal. Well, I decided to build my 914-6 into that rally car that I could do it because that particular event had to be 1973 and earlier cars. That car being a 1970 worked for that. But I entered that car in Panama. But the cool thing is you had a service crew. And there were two people in my service crew, a guy who we had known from Vasek Puluk in the early days of working with Porsche with my dad, of having his car being serviced there. He was Spanish-speaking and English-speaking, so it was perfect for an event that went through Central America. And my dad was in the service vehicle. So can you imagine, like, the guy who made me invest money at 13 years old with the deal I could eventually spend the money when I graduated from high school, here he is following me for 25 days in the car that I had bought with that money that I got to invest. It was just like, it was so cool. And my dad wasn't one of those guys who had done a lot of things worldly and had done, his passion was cars, yes, but he just hadn't done anything like that. And he's immersed in this full-on international event, chasing his kid, driving this car that he'd, you know, motivated to invest in the stock market. And we finished second overall and had an amazing race and everything. And, you know, it was probably, if my dad could share it now, it'd probably be one of his great moments in life of doing that. And so, you know, you just don't get that opportunity very often. And it was really something special.
Wow.
Where do you think you get that drive from? You say your father wasn't much of a worldly traveler. Did you take that after your mom?
A little bit. I mean, you know, if you look at the racing side of me and, you know, racing at Pikes Peak, which is, you know, a fairly daunting event and with some consequence. You know, I remember growing up, my mom was the one that had to go on the roof of the house to install the antenna because my dad was afraid of being on the roof, you know, up high in heights and things. But I think, you know, I think, Amelia, to your point, is like, it's also a little bit of an only child thing. I went to a different school every year till I was a junior in high school. It wasn't always because we were changing houses and moving and things, but my dad was in the plastics business, which was like a emerging big business. And so he was always getting offers to do things elsewhere and things like that. But that kind of having to do things for yourself and adapt to environments and to be kind of very aware of you're on your own. Yeah. And you got to do this. And my parents were very supportive. It wasn't like I was, you know, on my own in that way. But, you know, as a kid, you know, there's a generation. You want to be taking command of it. You know, you didn't have a lot of friends because you weren't dropping into, or you weren't living a life where, you know, you had lifetime friends and things like that. I was having to constantly make new friends.
It's so fascinating to hear you say this because doesn't sound like I went to as many different schools as you did, but in my high school years, I went to a new high school every single year. Mm-hmm. And the traits that you're talking about of, like, I fortunately have the childhood friends who I'm still in touch with today, but constantly having to meet new people, almost growing up on your own terms in a way. And there's just a certain element that at the time I didn't understand, but looking back at it really gave me this grounding that it sounds like we share.
And, you know, I think also the other thing that it, for me at least, and I mean, this is more career oriented, but it really spawned a lot of creativity, you know, because you had to, you know, we weren't internet bound. We weren't, you know, entertained naturally by technology. you had to figure out ways to be entertained. And you know, for that, since I didn't, you know, I came home from school, I wasn't really hanging with my friends because I was new to the school, you know, so I ended up being, I think, more motivated to be creative and be self-motivated to make something on your own because you didn't have that reliance. And in a lot of ways, you know, if you look at going into ultimately photography and then directing, is that it kind of comes back on you. You have to own it. Yes, in filmmaking, we have an amazing support system and all these departments that work for you, but it still comes back to, it's got to be your signature. It's got to be your vision. Otherwise, you know, your shelf life in the business probably isn't that great. And I do remember the first time when I started visiting production companies that wanted me to direct, they told me flat out, you know, this is, you know, you got about a 7-year shelf life in this world of advertising directing because, you know, it's a very much an on to the next, the new guys, the new views, things like that. But, you know, I'm in my 35th year of doing that and it's still just as fun and as exciting as it was in the beginning. And I think that, like I told you at the beginning of this, it's kind of like like I said, the good news is I've been doing this for a long time. The bad news, I've been doing it for a long time because I also want to always have things evolve, always have things change, because that's what stimulates me the most now.
That's really beautiful because a lot of folks, even myself, I catch myself being stuck in the old ways, right? And then it kind of, I'm turning into the old guy. I'm like, these young whippersnappers, right? It wasn't like that when I was young.
Yeah.
Back in my day.
Yeah. Well, I had the worldwide.
And I can take it to another generation for sure. So, you know, and it's funny because, you know, in the beginning of your career, you kind of, you just want to be so focused and you want to just be, you know, no outside influences. This is me. This is who I'm going to be. And, you know, you have to kind of hand it off to being, okay, who around me is doing the cool stuff? You know, I got to start being aware of that. And I think that that was one of the keys is I kind of handed that off earlier. Maybe I didn't hold on to just this, like, I don't care what anybody else is doing. I'm doing this. I really wanted to know what was going on. And it's almost like, you know, in the creative process, it's almost like a flip book. Like, you want to go through a whole bunch of images really quickly and take what you think you saw. Not open up and study a picture and say, I'm going to do something just like that, but like flip through something and see these things all flash by and you think, I think I saw something kind of cool. And then where's your mind take it?
Wow,
you know,
that's great.
So that you don't end up like just copying somebody.
Right,
you know,
right,
you don't
want
to do that. I think, you know, one of my greatest compliments from my kids a few years ago was she said to me, how do you stay so relevant? And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. But the reality is, if I am relevant, you know, it's from people like you guys, from people like, you know, the race service guys or the whatever, you know, there's so many people in our business that I love watching evolve. You know, I think that one of the single important things, at least for me, is leaving room to be in awe of others.
Beautiful.
That's to me, I wish so many people, filmmakers and people that I see, knew how in awe I am of what they do. You know, because my crews are 60 to 80 people. I mean, you've been on features, you guys, and you've seen all this. And I mean, like when you're on a feature, it's 120, 130 people, whatever. But I'm in awe of the guys that go out with 2 or 3 people and just do wonderful films.
Yeah.
And I take that influence into my own life all the time, every day virtually. But leaving that room to be in awe is so important, as opposed to, I'm just this, and I'm that, I'm going to go out every day. No, you know, got to leave that window open. You know, it's like bad weather. You know, we're in a business of filmmaking of you got to have great weather, you got to have this, but honestly, bad weather has given me more opportunity than it's taken away. You know, the amount of times I've been filming and a wall of blacks coming this way and everybody's worried that we're going to have this or whatever, the scenes it's created and the opportunities and even the motivation to move quicker and get things done, it's just cool. You know, it's like, as a director, you want to control everything, but you have to respect the fact that there's so many elements as you don't have control over.
Sure.
So.
I mean, this is, I think this is something I really needed to hear.
Same.
You know, on a personal level and in terms of like, you know, career as well, because as I start getting older, like I go, I wonder if, you know, I'm going to be like aged out of like opportunities. And what you just said is like, it rings like, I mean, it's just great words of wisdom that I'll, you know, walk away with. And, you know, it's like, hey, you know, root for the younger people, right? And it's like, I think about it and I'm like, hey, the fact that, you know, I was there early on and you can kind of like, you know, pave the way. And then you see all of these great opportunities that other, you know, people of color are having or my, you know, Asian American men are having. It's like, be in awe.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and it's such a beautiful, positive way to be present.
Yeah.
Right. And still, and it's not about you anymore. It's about like the whole, you know?
Absolutely.
It's really beautiful.
It's a handoff of competing, which is important in the beginning.
Yeah.
To collaborating.
Yeah.
You know, it's a simple process that I don't think you realize you kind of have to go through, you know, in a way. And I think that that's, you know, filmmaking is so definitive in so many ways. And interestingly, my parallels, you know, if I were to just take from my racing side, the event of Pikes Peak, which is, you know, a mountain we race up. I've raced over 20 years there. I've done well there. I understand the place. The place is home. But it's still so definitive. And it's one run on race day. It's a finish line that is at 14,115 feet. There's no pit stops.
I'm
there's
smiling as you talk. I want to do this so badly. Yeah, Pikes Peak is the dream.
And you should. You should. But yet, all those same variables we have in filmmaking of weather and crew and, you know, budgets and all this management goes into, you know, I'm under 10 minutes racing there. I'm one of the few people that are under 10 minutes. And it's like, you got to put it all into that little package in the same way. But it's definitive again. You got to get to the summit no matter what. And there's no second chances. There's not like you can't bring it back in the way in filmmaking. We don't, in my entire career, I've never gotten to a sunset and said, you know, we didn't get everything. We need to come back tomorrow. That doesn't happen.
Mm.
That's in my world, that's a $200,000 fault.
Mm.
You know, you don't just say, oh, didn't get it all. I got to come back tomorrow. That sunset, that thing, the day that's managed through your assistant directors and crew and everything else, it's all for that moment of being done at sunset. You know, we don't just start bringing out the lights when the sun goes down. Yeah. We don't have the chance of bringing the sun back up, all those things. And I love that pressure. And I think that's why my racing paralleling with my filmmaking, there is so many things in the process that I approach in the same way.
But when, for instance, like if you need to make your day on a film set or you need to get to the finish line and you don't make it, like how do you find peace with that? Because it's a 200,000 overage.
Can I add to your question? Because we're going down a path of a conversation we haven't had yet. You and I personally have, but not on this podcast, is also adding to Sung's question of what's your relationship with failure when that comes?
You know, that's a complicated one, I guess, because in my head, failure is a big deal. You know, I don't take it lightly. I want it to work. I can think of the moments of failure in motorsport, which is pretty definitive, usually because you've crashed or done something like that. In filmmaking, it's, you know, you fret over scenes that you might have missed and you didn't have a chance to do it, but experience gives you confidence knowing that you have the best people to edit, the best people to finish these things, but it's hanging over you. But in general, you want to be in a proactive position, not a reactive position. Your experience is going to give you the opportunity to be reactive, but the more you can plan and be proactive, creativity comes out. Creativity is in two areas. Creativity, pure creativity, is being aware of the moments you're filming and working on to enhance it in the best possible way to tell the story, both visual and from an editorial standpoint. But there's also creative to the solution, you know, your experience of, I can creatively make this scene work even though I don't have all the right elements there. So it's a balance, I guess, in that way. But I guess to your point, fear of failure, if you're fearing things in the process, creativity has a hard time coming out. It really does. It's like a blocker. You know, when you all of a sudden have to just be reactive, you're kind of on your heels, you know, and you want to be on your toes. You want to be able to move forward and have the big picture of the way things go together.
Being able to relinquish that control as a creative is very hard, right? Yeah. We were talking about that earlier, of like, you know, when something doesn't go right, then it all comes back on you. But if you can relinquish it, you're like, hey, you know, it's not just my fault, it's your fault.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Rosie, somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned. It feels so good.
It does. And like always, we'll be here every week covering the wide world of TV, movies, comics, and geek culture.
That's right. We'll be talking about Batman, heroes of that stature, and of course, we'll be inviting our friends in the industry to come geek out with us and share stories. We'll hear from TV writers, from actors, comics creators, pop culture critics, and more.
Nothing is off the table, because geek culture is pop culture, and we can't wait to share our love of it all with you every single week.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to announce a new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. Our guests this season remind us to embrace change and fearlessly look toward the future. Like Andrew Jarecki, award-winning filmmaker and creator of Movie Phone.
The studios didn't really control the theaters. The theaters didn't control the studios. And I thought, well, there's a window in here where I could make things easier for the consumer and also make something that would be very useful for the industry.
Or Kellen Kenny, chief marketing and growth officer at AT&T, who installed fiber in customers' houses rather than leading from afar.
It is so crucial that you spend time with the customers. That is the best lesson.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to a brand new season of Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry, though. He's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, you started shooting, basically, it was analog, right? Mm-hmm. And today, moving into CG and
AI. You don't
even, yeah, AI, right?
A whole other thing.
I mean, are you as open-minded about that as well, of like that pushing the bar for action sequences with cars?
It's really interesting. And again, it's kind of like I started in film and you had 400-foot magazines, you know, and that ran for a certain amount of time. You know, it was like everything was based on changing film and things like that. You know, now we leave cameras rolling. We have multiple cameras working. And, you know, when I was at Art Center, I got into mounting cameras. I was mounting cameras on my skateboards, on biplane wings, on all sorts of things. And I just loved doing that. And my first road and track cover was actually a camera rig on a car going down a road. And so it was like this time tunnel, blurry look. It really kind of showed action, and I love that. And you know, now we're in the GoPro era and all things, everything's gotten smaller, everything's gotten more usable. And you know, there was a moment in time too where changing over from film to digital, I shot with a different camera system every job. You know, it was evolving so quickly, and the way things are evolving, it's an opportunity, but in some ways it stands in the way. And I was very much a person that I felt like I needed to be genuine to filmmaking, genuine to the car. I was in an area where I was a high action specialist. So generally I'd be shooting cool cars, you know, that were truly capable of that. And I always felt like if they needed to go into special effects and different things at that time, it was kind of taking away from the, you know, believability that car could really do it. So my goal was, by working with people like Reese and Tanner and Paul Dahlenbach, these guys that could put a car anywhere and do everything, I wanted to really show the real action. I really wanted to be part of that, so that if you ever pulled back on the curtain on it, you actually saw it happen. You know, there was a genuine nature to it. I was fortunate to be shooting a car that was genuinely capable. Let's film it in a way that it's really doing those things. And so, again, it's up to you as a filmmaker to put cameras in places. I wanted to not just watch a car. I wanted it to make you blink, to feel like it was going to hit you or defy logic or do things like that. You know, it's like I said, as a filmmaker, I want to be on my toes. As a viewer, I want to be on my heels. Like, whoa, you know, this is it. You know, so I look at what's happening now, and obviously AI is going to be a whole nother category of things, but there was a moment in time where effects and plates that we would shoot and all these kind of tedious parts of filmmaking ultimately didn't add up to as pure of experience of watching a car as I wanted. And so my goal was always to put that car on the edge. And as a director, I've spent 20 years of my life racing up the side of a mountain, putting wheels, half the tread on the pavement, half the tread touching the edge of the road, you know, putting those moments in precision on a mountain with huge consequence. You know, that perspective plays out in my own filmmaking because I'm already looking at things that way. I have a funny handoff. Like, I run the Colorado Hill Climb Championship, which is dirt roads up the side of a mountain in a GT3 cup car. It's raw, it's pure. It's a bunch of old timers who quit racing at Pikes Peak because it got paved. They just all want to be on the dirt and stuff. I will pitch a car in the corner, rotate the car, drive on the throttle. I'll feel that right front wheel just bound a little bit over a rock or something in the corner, and I feel it go light. I feel it touch back down, and the attitude is just right. The wheels are set. You just can feel the outside wheels tearing at the earth. All this stuff's happening. My head will go, oh, I hope somebody's out there with a 200 millimeter lens. Roll it away at 120 frames a second. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because that would be a great shot. Yeah, you know? Yeah. So, and then I do that. And it's funny because lately at Pike's Peak, I think about what it looks like on the outside.
That's funny.
And I try to put the car exactly in those moments, you know, and my perspective is already at the edge of the mountain.
Mm.
My perspective is already taking something to the ragged edge limit, that sort of thing. So I almost pick up in filmmaking at that point rather than build up to it.
Mm.
So it's that kind of perspective that I bring to it. And I actually think that my racing has fed the longevity to my career. Because if I sit in a client meeting and somebody's got some new hot car talking about, I can put it in perspective of what that car can feel like, look like, and be emotional about it. This isn't just a job for me. This is a quest to share my passion with the rest of the world through filmmaking.
Mm. You know, our friend Brian Scotto, who, you know, Brian, right? Who I feel like he is really pushing the envelope, or I guess redefining like how cars are shot, action sequences.
Absolutely.
And he coined this phrase. I don't know if he coined it or he borrowed it or maybe even stole it from you. But he has this phrase called honest angle.
Uh-huh.
Right. Yeah. And he's like, and we were talking about, because I always ask people, like, what do you think the problem with fast like action sequences from the Fast and Furious? And it's like, it's not honest. You know, it's like, you know, they're cool cars, but when a car's like going from like one building to the other,
to
like
outer space,
or outer space, it's like, it's not honest.
Yeah.
And it's like, what I'm listening to you is like, you shoot the car honestly, like, because you understand how the car would actually perform in reality. You were able to convert that, you know, onto screen. And then the audience, it is like a visceral reaction to
absolutely.
It, opposed to, oh, that's a special effect, right? And it kind of just,
appreciate it less.
Yeah. Right? It's like junk food, right? Yeah. It's just easy. Like, you know, it's like,
I don't know. You did say your favorite pizza was Domino's.
That's not junk food.
Your favorite burger was Big Mac.
No, Jeff.
No.
What? No. Domino's pizza?
I'm with you.
Is it your favorite pizza in the world?
You know what? There's a certain thing you give up in convenience, let's say.
I'll give you that.
It's delicious pizza.
It's good. Stuff should taste like a pizza.
Yes. Okay, anyway, let's go back.
Well, I don't know whether Brian told you, but there is a directorial team known as Zwarto. That's Jeff Zwart and Brian Scotto. Zwarto. We directed Climb Kana together.
Oh.
And so when Ken Block
decided to go to Pike's Peak, we
directed that together.
Yes.
And
Zwarto.
It was fun because the amount of times I would sit in a client meeting in Detroit or wherever, and I'd say, you know, we want a scene kind of like that Ken Block stuff. You know, they would refer to it or whatever. And Ken was so good at putting a car on the edge and doing all that. So naturally, when this project came up and I was asked to direct with Brian, I was just like, wow, this is so cool. And I learned so much in it. To your point of like, you know, the style and look and feel of filming. And, you know, Ken, I think I'd even raced with him at one point or things, but we'd been, you know, certainly been around each other and seen all the Gymkhanas and everything at that point. But what was super cool was Ken would have his opinions about the way we needed to film.
Mm.
And, you know, it's kind of like in your mind, you have a routine and the way you film, and this is your process and stuff. And I started to understand why things were different in a lot of ways with the way Scotto had approached it and the way their teams had filmed Ken and then Ken's ideals. And one of the things was interesting because my office is a Cayenne armed camera car with a big arm on the roof. And, you know, I go, you know, that's my world and always tracking and doing moves and things. And Ken goes, I don't like those. I don't like camera cars. And I thought, well, you know, this is the way I work, you know, we'll have a camera car. But you started to realize that the moment the camera was traveling with his car, it slowed his car down. Mm-hmm. You know, as soon as you start matching speeds,
right,
things start to slow down. And I kind of knew that. I did know it, but I hadn't really applied it. And it wasn't until Ken kind of said, I don't like camera cars, I started to put the whole thing together. And stylistically, that's what I really liked about Gymkhana. And we always have conversations about what was the best one, which is the best one. We all look at different ones of which is best. But the first one that I ever saw, and this is when I'm well into my filmmaking career, I felt like I'd climbed over the fence and gotten into something that I shouldn't be there for.
Such an interesting way to put it.
And got to record it and see something that, like, let's just put that away before anybody catches us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was that kind of, that tension and everything of like, I'm in here, I'm going to get this, and then I got to get out of here because somebody's going to bust me. You know, that moment and spontaneity and the way that played out in front of you with them just ripping it up at El Toro Marine Base, you know, it was like, that was cool. And, you know, there were times where it maybe got too polished or times where it got, you know, a little bit of away from that purity, but then it kept coming back to that. And Ken also just developing as a driver, everything about it was such a great franchise. And without it really, you know, consciously affecting me, I just know that so much of their work played out in influencing me. And honestly, you know, a little over a year ago when I got the phone call that Ken had passed, it was when that really kind of all rained down on me. This guy was a huge part of my life, even though we weren't directly hanging out best buddy friends. The effect of my life, my industry, everything about it it really came to me at that moment and still affects me in that way.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, you know, as one gets older in life and you deal with loss, I mean, it's something that I'm noticing. It's like every few months now I get a phone call and, you know, someone is passing and it scares me. You know, it's like it really, really scares me. And I still don't know how to deal with it. I don't know if I'll ever know how to deal with it. I mean, how do you deal with loss as you get older?
I got to say that within my family, at least, I've been very fortunate that I haven't really had any surprise losses. You know, my grandparents were farmers and they lived in their 90s. My parents lived in the 90s. You know, there were no real kind of surprises within the family. I've certainly lost race driver friends along the way, because that's, you know, it happens in the decades that I've been involved in racing. And I've started losing some friends who, you know, we grew up with together and just lately. And I think that's part of it. I, you know, having the perspective of what you've been able to do in your life and be part of. And like I said before, being in awe of others and being inspired of others and kind of keeping that going. I, you know, Ken was one of the more difficult ones because it was almost like you just realized you hadn't spent enough time. You hadn't taken it as seriously as maybe you should have of what that guy provided, not just for you, but for the whole car culture, all that sort of thing. So it is difficult, but I also savor so much. And I feel it's so important not to have regrets and feel like you've been pure to yourself and chased your passions and been able to be constantly invigorated. You know, it's like perpetual motion. When things feed something and it just keeps it going, that's the way I look at my career, you know? It's always been interesting. Every element has been interesting. Every day of the life has been interesting. I love going against the elements. You know, I love being provided challenges, even at this age. You know, I'm not looking for the easy path. You know, the worst day is bright and sunny and perfect conditions. You know, that's not the worst day, but you know what I mean? I like the challenge. I love that fact that you are just going against life and succeeding, mm-hmm. you know? And I love to see that in other people. And I love the underdogs. I love the people that have looked at life differently. Those kinds of moments just make such a dynamic, engaging world, because elements in life, whether it be life or death or health or weather or anything, it's part of our life. And you love to see people succeed in that. And I that's the part that really kind of motivates me and other people, is watching that. I love watching new filmmakers and people that haven't even been educated in school. You know, they've just done it on their own. I love that kind of vibrancy of because the only reason for success in that environment is passion. That's it.
Well said. That's really beautiful. Yeah. This has been a great conversation.
It really has been, yeah. I feel like I'm going to leave this a better person.
Well, I agree.
It's all for us. And I think that's the point of our world, is just that we can kind of feed off each other and take advantage of the relationships in the best possible ways and take away the good and understand the bad, and that balance of understanding how important a life is around us to be able to come back to and share in it and live in it and give people space to be part of that is so important. Going back to it, it's like, you know, you guys are my inspiration. It's a new generation of inspiration. And I just leave those doors open to be inspired by others. But you guys are great. Love it.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Hi there. I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to announce a new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. Our guests this season show us big risk can yield big rewards, like Rob Reilly, the creative head of one of the world's leading advertising firms.
I try to create environments where anybody can say anything without any judgment.
Listen to a brand new season of Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.